Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the beloved Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Daniel Foster, news editor at National Review Online, and for Jim Garrity today, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And, Dan, one of the things that Jim and I were worried about when about a week ago now Mitt Romney picked Paul Ryan as his running mate was whether the Republicans had a good defense ready when inevitably people would accuse Paul Ryan and, by proxy, Mitt Romney of trying to gut Medicare and shove grandma off a cliff when it comes to reforming entitlements, whether the campaign would be ready for it. And the good news so far, we'll see if their argument's working, they at least have a defense ready to go. And they're getting a little bit of help along the way from some archival footage from President Obama with Jake Tapper a few years ago. PolitiFact saying that 2011's biggest lie was that the Ryan plan would gut Medicare as we know it. And PolitiFact is not exactly down the middle. They'd usually lean left. So for them to say that's a lie, the lie of the year, is pretty impressive. So here's Mitt Romney just yesterday explaining why his plan for Medicare is better than what the president has done, both for current seniors and for future seniors.
The plan stays the same. No adjustments, no changes, no savings. The president's plan cuts Medicare by $716 billion. In addition, the trustees of Medicare estimate that approximately 4 million people will lose their coverage under Medicare Advantage.
And that was for current seniors. Here's what people under 55 have to look forward to.
And under the president's plan, this goes bankrupt. The Medicare trustees have notified the president that the plan will go bankrupt, Medicare Part A, in approximately 12 years. Under the plan that I proposed, it is solvent.
And if that weren't enough, Dan, you've got the vice chair of the DNC Hispanic Caucus, Andres Ramirez, saying, both Ryan's plan and the president cut $700 billion from Medicare, so in the end, it's really not that big of a deal. It's awkward for conservatives to be defending Medicare to some extent, but right now it seems like they've got their ducks in a row far more than the Democrats on this, and so this may not be the third rail that we thought it was.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I think the dynamics on this surprised everybody, took everybody a little off guard, including myself. When the Ryan pick first happened, I had a real mix of reactions. I was excited as a conservative, but as a guy who wants to win, I was, nervous. Not that I thought it was a bad pick, but I thought it was a volatile pick. And obviously the Medicare line of attack was one of the big worries in my mind. But it's been kind of amazing to me. And as you said, we don't know if we're going to win the debate in November. But it's been amazing to me how quickly Ryan and Romney have been able to put the Obama campaign on the defensive on this thing, at the very least. That's been the most surprising aspect of it to me. Now Obama has to defend his plan. He has to explain to seniors why $700 billion in cuts were necessary to help him pay for this new healthcare entitlement, in Obamacare. And as you said, the Romney plan, well, what is it? It's not the Ryan plan, but the Ryan plan isn't even the Ryan plan, because there's the roadmap, there's Wyden Ryan. There's a few different iterations of it. And Paul Ryan, I'm second to none in my fanboy appreciation for Paul Ryan. But he's also, as Ross Douthat has been doing a really good job of pointing out in the New York Times on his blog the last couple of days, Ryan is an art of the possible guy. He's just, his brilliance is that he's been very good in the Republican caucus over the last 6 years or so at making what's possible more conservative. And so, but we still have to operate within the constraints of what we can realistically get done on Medicare. And Ryan's been so good at pushing that debate to the right that now we're having it on our turf. And we're talking about, there are people complaining that his reforms don't cut Medicare enough. And, if we're complaining about the supposedly untouchable Ryan budget, about whether or not we should cut more from Medicare, well, that's an interesting turn of events. So I agree with you that this has not been the stake in the heart out of the gate that I worried, part of me worried it would be. And if there's anyone, this is not the most profound insight, but if there's anyone who can make this argument, it's Paul Ryan.
Yeah, absolutely right. And Jim and I talked yesterday about how a new Rasmussen poll in Florida, which obviously has a lot of seniors, may tilt a little to the right, but it shows Romney up 45-43. If the president's anywhere close to 43 as an incumbent in Florida, that bodes very well and shows that the scare tactics have not worked to this point. So we'll see what happens from here. We still have 80-some days to go. But so far, the defense and the offense, actually, of the Romney-Ryan campaign has been very good on what is often a very complicated issue. On to martini number two now, Dan. And we have been very critical, and I think rightly so, in the past of shady voter registration efforts when it comes to certainly Acorn in previous cycles. There's the group in Virginia that for some reason won't be prosecuted despite the fact that they're trying to register dead people and pets and all sorts of other things, which obviously would skew the system and rob legitimate voters of their influence in the political system. So we cannot stand idly by and not condemn what appears to be an ever-worsening story as it relates to now former Michigan Congressman Thaddeus McCotter, everyone's favorite kind of congressional curmudgeon for many years. Very dry, Jim likens him to Stephen Wright with a very just dry sense of humor. But he resigned kind of abruptly not that long ago after it was found out that he did not qualify for the ballot because he didn't have enough valid signatures. And so he ultimately decided not to do a write-in campaign and then ultimately decided not even to fill out his term. Now John Fund is reporting on your very website, National Review Online, that this goes much deeper. He probably should not have qualified for the 2008 or 2010 ballots, and his staff increasingly has submitted fraudulent signatures in order to get him on the ballot. Only this time he finally got caught. Dan, this is just horrifying. It's either extremely lazy or flat out corrupt, and you got to call it when it happens to our party too.
Yeah, it's a very bad scene, and by all you know, we've John Fund's been working on it, and we have some other things in the cooker here at National Review Online. And everything I've seen and heard kind of on background is that it doesn't go all the way up to McCotter in terms of, you know, being complicit in this stuff. But certainly what you said about him being kind of asleep at the switch and lazy is the sense that we're getting. And that he just, I mean, McCotter was always a bit off. You know, I mean, a lot of people liked his style. He was considered by some even to be the, you know, 5-6 years ago to be this great white hope, a guy who wasn't a traditional politician, who had a little bit of a different energy and as you said, was kind of curmudgeonly. And as somebody here put it this morning, had a very kind of 19th century politician vibe to him in some ways. And, but the flip side to that was here's a guy who just didn't seem to be that plugged into what his staff was doing in his name, either in the case of these, you know, criminally fraudulent activities, or just in general in the case of not being well coordinated with his staff on a lot of issues. And by all accounts, he's gone completely off the grid now and isn't making much of a peep. But yeah, it's one of those things where in hindsight, it looks like, you know, if you understand the dynamics of his office, it's one of those things that in hindsight looks like, well, of course, you know, which is unfortunate thing to say.
A guy who just not that long ago was considered to be heavily recruited for the Senate race in Michigan this year. He ultimately decided against that. I guess if getting signatures for your congressional district is an uphill climb, getting enough signatures on the ballot for a Senate campaign might be more than you want to take on, and he decided not to do that. Now, of course, he's out of Congress altogether. So on to martini number three now, and Dan, we haven't had any fun with Nancy Pelosi in a while now. This story doesn't specifically relate to her, but it relates to her family. Her husband, Paul Pelosi, is a co-owner of a UFL football team. This is a league that just started a couple of years ago and is considered to be fairly credible, obviously not at the level of the NFL. And the franchise that Mr. Pelosi co-owned agreed to hire and sign Dennis Green, former coach of the Vikings, former coach of the Cardinals, to coach this team. And now Green is suing Pelosi and the other co-owners for breach of contract. I believe it's in excess of $1 million. And I don't know what Dennis Green's political leanings are, but if he is a conservative, Dan, and everybody knows what clip I'm about to play, his conclusion to this whole story is somewhere along these lines.
But they are who we thought they were.
And so you remember that rant from Dennis Green after his Cardinals blew a big lead against the Chicago Bears a few years ago. Right now, the Pelosis are now on the receiving end of the rage of Dennis Green.
One of my favorite bits from this story over this lawsuit is the reminder that the Pelosi's net worth jumped 62% in 1 year between 2010 and 2011, mostly due to this, and I just use every opportunity I can, forgive me, to remind people of this, mostly due to the fact that they got a sweetheart deal on an IPO from Visa, at the same time that Nancy Pelosi was overseeing credit card regulation, her and her husband got a, you know, once in a lifetime, no individual investors get this kind of access deal on an IPO, and they made a ton of money on it. And here she is saying, you know, Harry Reid heard right, you know, Mitt Romney didn't pay any taxes. And we know that her net worth has increased 62% in 1 year due to a sweetheart deal. But anyway, it seems as though Mr. Pelosi, you know, might have some other questionable business dealings. And the details that Denny alleges are pretty bad. You know, he signed this contract for $1.5 million with Pelosi. He uprooted his kids and his family from San Diego, moved them to Sacramento, which is where the Mountain Lions are based. At some point, Pelosi, who said this wasn't going to be a vanity purchase, that he was going to run it like a business and an investment, at some point he just stopped paying Denny's checks, which is at least allegedly, and he started, you know, it's hard to cry too hard for the guy because he was getting $62,000 every 2 weeks, according to the details, but at some point he cut the amount in the paychecks at some weeks, some biweekly pay periods down to $5,000, so that's a big cut from $62,000. And then apparently just stopped paying altogether. And if the facts that he alleges hold up, then the Pelosi's are probably going to go ahead and want to settle this pretty quickly.
And if Mitt Romney's correct on Medicare, that's a great metaphor for the Obama Medicare plan. Eventually, you'll just stop getting checks and getting things reimbursed for. So everything comes full circle, Dan.
That's right.
Well, Dan, thanks so much for filling in for Jim today. Have a fabulous weekend, and we'll talk to you most likely during the convention weeks coming up. So we look forward to that. Thanks again.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Daniel Foster is news editor at National Review Online. I'm Greg Karumbas of Radio America. Please join Brett Winterbull in for me next week. Jim Garrity will be back on Monday for the next edition of the Three Martini Lunch.